Welcome to Truth All Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 29th of January 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at RadioAlbion.com, because we have with us BitChute producer Horus. Horus, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Good day to you, Sven. Thanks for having me back on. I'm doing all right. I'm looking forward to discussing our topic further today, and I hope your regular co-host is still on the mend and doing all right.
Yeah, he is. He's doing well. I spoke to him the other day. We're hoping to have him back in 3 weeks, 4 weeks now, and I believe he's hoping to do an interview with somebody possibly this weekend or next weekend as he gets used to podcasting again. And I also wanted to bring up the fact that there is now a DVD edition of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, that is available once again. It hasn't been available for 3 or 4 years now, I think. It's been unavailable, and there is now a new version that is available. There's a link to it in the sidebar at the Radio Albion site, the TWO Films icon. If you click that, it will take you to the page, and you can buy the four-disc set, and a certain amount of the profits from that will go to Dennis. So you're directly helping Dennis out by purchasing a copy of that, and it's a high definition copy. I don't think you can watch it anymore in Britain on BitChute. Obviously, there's nothing hateful in it at all. It's just talking about the war from the other side of the war, basically the side of it that we've never actually heard. But that was back out again last week, so that's a bit of good news there. Did you have a nice week off? I noticed you've been fairly busy looking at your BitChute channel, Horus.
Yeah, just since I last spoke to you, I mean, I've continued this sort of loose series I'm doing about the counter-jihad movement and how it relates to what I would call real nationalism, how it inhibits real nationalism, and why we need to understand, well, that's the reason why we need to understand it properly. I had some really interesting discussions about that, so if people want to see, check out my BitChute channel, the most recent videos. I also did a chat with Mark on Tuesday, Mark Collett, talking about our shared hatred of the Conservative Party, who I think many nationalists would agree needs to be defeated if we're going to have a genuinely patriotic or nationalistic government in Britain. So they're in our way. So, we were discussing that. Really enjoyed that. So, yeah, I've been busy, yeah.
And we'll be discussing the left tonight, possibly a little bit about the Labour Party and talking about Jews and the left as we continue our series on Kevin MacDonald's Culture of Critique trilogy. Just before we get into that, I just want to highlight once again that what we're doing here is we are looking at and analysing various evolutionary group strategies that the Jews have used, particularly Judaism itself as a religion. And these strategies that they use are there to advance their cause, to advance the cause of their extended kinship group. And all groups use these strategies. And the reason why we study them is not to make people hostile to the Jews or to incite hatred or anything like that. It's so that we can learn from that about our own strategies, so that we can counter these strategies if they are detrimental to us in any way, and we can come up with strategies of our own to forward our own cause. The Jews have been particularly successful over the last century, and Professor Kevin MacDonald, he details some of the ways that they've done this, leading the intellectual movements, forming a large part of the left wing in politics, having an effect on immigration policy, all these things that benefit the Jews, but they may not benefit the host nation so much, but they're great for the Jews. So you cannot condemn Jews for doing that in any way whatsoever, because that is obviously their purpose, is to do what is best for the group. The issue we have is with white people as a group who are not doing what is best for our group. We're the ones that are in the wrong here and that need to change our thinking. And hopefully by doing a series like this one, where we look at the ways these other groups behave in our society, we can learn from that. And as I say, we can counter these strategies and we can develop our own. And we're talking this week again about the third book in the series, which is actually called The Culture of Critique, An Evolutionary Analysis of Jewish Involvement in 20th Century Intellectual Movements. And as I say, we're going to get on to the Jews and the left tonight. But before we get into that, I've just got a quote here that I didn't get to use last week from the book. The authoritarian personality, that's the book by Horkheimer that we were talking about, part of the Frankfurt School. The authoritarian personality attempts to show that Gentile group affiliations, and particularly membership in Christian religious sects, Gentile nationalism, and close family relationships are an indication of psychiatric disorder. Thus, in Horkheimer's essay on German Jews, see Horkheimer 1974, he says the true enemy of the Jews is Gentile collectivities of any kind, and especially nationalism. Although no mention is made of the collectivist nature of Judaism, Zionism, or Israeli nationalism, the prescription for Gentile society is radical individualism and the acceptance of pluralism. And what this does is it makes it easier for the Jews as a minority to retain their sense of identity and their group affiliation, while all those around them are having their group affiliations weakened. And it's just part of this competition, is part of this game that is going on between these groups. So that's one of their strategies, is to weaken the group affiliations in the other groups that they are competing with. Unless, of course, they happen to actually be leading the group. But we'll get back onto that in a minute. So what they're actually saying is that wanting to be part of a family, wanting to be part of a church, wanting to be a nationalist, that this is an indication of a psychiatric disorder. And that's what this Horkheimer is promoting in his book. And they actually get to the stage where ethnocentrism has now been reframed as racism, which, again, is said to be a psychiatric disorder when it shows in whites. But it's actually encouraged in, say, the civil rights movement, which was actually led by Jews, and it's encouraged in Zionism. Again, it's led by Jews. That's specifically for Jewish interests. But when white people wish to do the same thing, and when we wish to stand up and advocate for whites and organize together on the basis of our ethnicity, then that gets reframed as racism and reframed as a bad thing. And we can see that this all goes all the way back to this, to the Frankfurt School and the authoritarian personality people. But I think that really sums it up, is this idea that when non-Jews get together into any collectivity, it is therefore a threat to Jews. Because if it's non-Jews getting together in this collectivity, then by definition, that Jews aren't included in that. So they can't have an influence in it, particularly not if it's ethno-nationalism. So that means that they're not as strong in the competition then when that sort of thing happens. They don't have as much power as they have when they can break everything down and nobody can form together in any groups at all. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Horace, at all.
Yeah, I think the sort of pathologization of white ethnocentrism, along with, I think, the imposition of hate speech laws and a few other aspects of Jewish activism, I think they are the things that really reveal what I believe MacDonald is talking about in this whole series, especially in Culture of Critique, which is that various things that wear the mask of, you know, I mean, the authoritarian personality presents itself as an academic study. It's clearly not. It's risible by any sort of normal academic standards, I think. Things like this show that, you know, certain forms of Jewish activism are, that they should be understood as Jewish activism, as pro-Jewish activism, rather than, you know, there's nothing particularly sincere about the work of Adorno and Horkheimer in doing this F-scale thing. It's academically it's risible, but it once you understand it for what it is, it all makes sense, and it all makes sense in relation to loads of other kinds of Jewish activism, which as a combined front, you know, serve as a kind of, I don't know, a Jewish front, basically a front for Jewish, the pursuit of Jewish interests and of Jewish power. I think Adorno's work with you said Horkheimer, right? I think it was both of them. Their work on things like the authoritarian personality, which of course was published by, I believe it was the American Jewish Congress, if not the American Jewish Committee, obviously an ethnocentric organization, that really epitomizes the ethnic aspect of that activism. I think it really speaks for itself.
You know, I think last time we established that, you know, they would use pretty much anything if it would advance Jewish interests. And what they looked at, they thought, well, the fascism goes back to the family because you've got a father that's in charge and the children and the mother that is underneath. So basically we need to disintegrate the family and that will prevent fascism from arising again. So everything is looked at in the way of what can we do to make it benefit the Jews, which everybody should be looking at things like that for their individual people group. We should be looking at things and saying, well, how can we do things to make things better for whites? And we do this as nationalists, but the people with the sort of power that these intellectuals had, they're all going along with this idea that the authoritarian personality is what we should be following, instead of following our own traditions and the way that we think or the way that our societies used to be ordered. We're following these ideas that these intellectuals have given us, and the intellectuals that are giving us these ideas are in the main, they're Jewish, the ones that pick up on these ideas, and they also use non-Jews in these groups as well. Sometimes they'll put them forward as leaders, or they'll have Jewish wives, and they'll say, well, it's not an entirely Jewish group, but as we'll see when we look at when we get into looking at the left today, a lot of the left, I mean, over 50% of them in some instances were actually made up of Jews. But just before we get to that, I mean, we can also see the way that ethnocentrism and just simple patriotism has now been demonized and pathologized recently when we saw the patriots in the Capitol chanting USA, USA, walking in with American flags, and they're now being called domestic terrorists. And yet they were the patriots that went into the Capitol in support of the established government, and they were being accused of being insurrectionists. And an insurrection is rebellion against the established government. And the established government at the time was the Donald Trump administration. And that's who they were going in there supporting. And yet they are now being arrested and charged with conspiracy to commit terrorism. And they've been made out to be the bad guys. It's like everything has been turned on its head, because instead of having us in these important roles, we have people that are subservient to these Jewish interests in these important roles. And that isn't to make people hostile to Jews. That's to say that they're doing very well in this competition at the moment. Certainly been winning for the last century, I think, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, the reaction to that so-called insurrection, I don't even think riot, I think riot was too strong a word, let alone insurrection. I think the reaction to that was very revealing in that, calling it insurrection, I think also insurgency has been used, and also traitor and treason. I heard Antifa people referring to Ashley Babbitt as a traitor. She died a traitor's death, they say. That says something. That says that the people using those terms consider themselves, identify themselves with the American state now and with the American government. They consider themselves the establishment, and anyone who rebels against them or does things that they find threatening or objectionable in any way is now to be termed an enemy of the state. That is a display of thinking of themselves in power. And I think, mostly that was Jewish led. Certainly the Anti-Defamation League took a lead on that. And the Anti-Defamation League tends to get what it wants, sometimes with just a couple of hours delay. And it did that, I think it did that day. A day or two before that, it called for Donald Trump to be removed from Twitter, and that wish was granted within a couple of hours. And then the ADL, I guess, got a bit carried away and demanded for him to be removed from office, whereas I think the rest of the establishment thought that wouldn't really be worth the trouble. that very language, insurrection and traitor, that is a display of power in itself.
They've changed the meaning of so many words. I mean, they changed the meaning of the word bigot to meaning the opposite. It always meant somebody that was intolerant of other people's opinions. And they've now made it to mean something to do with race. So somebody that only wants to hear that. No, I can't even work out I can't recall what it is, but they have completely changed it. I was really surprised that they had actually changed it in every dictionary.
But yeah, they use it to refer to just anyone who's genuinely right-wing, I think. And you see people on the centre-right using it like that as well, as in the people on the centre-right are phonies. They're fake conservatives. They will use the word bigot to refer to, you know, patriots, nationalists, traditionalists, and so on.
Yeah, it's supposed to mean, you know, somebody that is intolerant of other people's opinion. It's a perfect description to use to describe the people that are on the left. But now it gets used against us. And as I say, the group affiliations, so long as they're actually led by the Jews, then they are okay. And when you have a group affiliation that is led by the Jews, it will nearly always be on the left-hand side of things. You still get Jews that are involved in the right-hand side of politics, but even the right-hand side of politics now goes along with the left, as I should imagine you were probably talking about with Mark Collett on the program that you did about the Conservative Party, how once the Conservative Party get into power, all they really do is conserve what the Labour Party have done. They don't undo it.
Worse than that.
Worse. Just like an escape valve, aren't they, really? People think they've got a right-wing organisation there or a proper conservative organisation, and it's not. It's just promoting these left-wing ideas. And I actually found a good description of what the left is at Wikipedia. They say left-wing politics supports social equality and egalitarianism, often in opposition to social hierarchy. What is social hierarchy? Social hierarchy is the existing order. So it's against order, basically. Everything throughout the natural world is in a hierarchy, and the left is in opposition to that hierarchy. And they support what they call social equality and egalitarianism. Again, that is against the natural order of things, that there is a hierarchy, and that is what they are specifically against. To begin with, I've got a quote here to do with this, and Kevin McDonald says, "The association between Jews and the political left has been widely noticed and commented on beginning in the 19th century. Whatever their role in almost every country about which we have information, a segment of the Jewish community played a very vital role in movements designed to undermine the existing order." And that's from a book written by Rothman and Lichter, 1982. They're both Jewish authors. So the Jews do admit what they're actually doing here. And the whole left-wing idea is to sow chaos, basically. It's to undermine the existing order. And yet we have the people calling themselves conservative parties that are now promoting these sort of ideas. This is why you get Jews that are involved in revolution, why there were so many of them that were involved in the Bolsheviks. I mean, Marx was a Jew, even though he wrote against the Jews, and yet his ideology has been used ever since then by these revolutionary Jews. And what they try to do is they try to overturn the social hierarchy, break down the existing order, but while at the same time retaining their Jewishness. So it's the same game again. It's dissolve everybody else's ability to collectivize and turn them all into individuals, while the Jewish group remains as a group. It retains its identity. I mean, it's very clever what they do. You know, you can't underestimate it. You have to admire it, and it is in tune with their racial character, which I think is why they are successful at it, is because it's in tune with their racial character. When we try to do things like that, that's not in tune with our racial character, and we won't succeed. We won't succeed by trying to turn everybody into individuals, because we'll just become individuals ourselves. So it doesn't work for us. I don't know if you want to make any comments on this desire of the left to undermine the existing order, Horus.
Just as to the last bit you said about how, yeah, that wouldn't work for us. I mean, that I think that also, yeah, I agree with what you said, that it's Jews acting in their natural sort of racial character. You know, it makes sense for them to do that. It advances their interests and so on. I also think that the other sort of, I don't know, sort of cleavage there is between us being, you know, the native population of Britain and Europe and so on, and arguably much of America, and because obviously it was a lot of that land was empty when it was settled for the first time by Europeans. So I don't agree that Europeans are simply invaders in America, as the left would say. But the fact that we're the native population, and Jews obviously in most places know themselves to be in a somewhat more precarious position, in a sense, in that if the natives turned against them, they would be expelled, or worse, as has happened. And there's nothing to celebrate there or lament. That is the fact. I think there is also, you know, to try and dissolve the society around you and to reduce it to individualism is something that appeals. It doesn't seem to be something that's particularly occurred to other ethnic groups who live in our lands, like, you know, Afro-Caribbeans or Indians. But it is something that quite a lot of them pick up very enthusiastically. I think they're generally given the lead on that, the intellectual and the sort of sometimes the material lead on that by Jews. You know, like with organisations like the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People in the USA, that was founded by Jews, and there's various other examples like that. It is something that would probably serve the interests of any ethnic group living as a minority, and certainly a scattered one across the world with no homeland. It makes more sense to Jews than anyone else. But about the leftist thing of opposing the existing order, obviously, to the extent that the existing order derives from nature, and I think that's a great deal. I mean, you know, the order that we see in human society, I think, is largely biological. And I think people like Ed Dutton and Kevin MacDonald would probably agree with that. I mean, they're evolutionary thinkers. I've formed that impression from reading people like them. It's actually, you know, it goes against what I was taught earlier in life, but I've come to think that it is the truth. To the extent that our societies are biological, then what it means really for leftists, and obviously the many Jews among the left, to oppose the existing order is to oppose nature. It is a war against nature, which is why a lot of people on the right just find it, apart from it being highly objectionable, it's also very hard to understand, like why anybody would want to go against nature. But I think, you know, when you consider the relation of Jews and the left, it's probably true that white leftists have different motivations in opposing nature from what Jews do. And for Jews, it helps in their ethnocentric pursuits. Whereas for white leftists, I mean, Ed Dutton's really, really illuminating on this. But I mean, if I can just sort of feebly paraphrase his thinking on this, is that whites... No, actually, I can't. I'll just refer people to Ed Dutton's work, but I think white leftists get into this. I mean, virtue signaling seems to be a major thing in Dutton's work, and that makes sense. I mean, that obviously virtue signaling in itself serves a social function. I'm pretty sure that Jews who get involved in the left have, you know, generally ethnocentric motivations. It's complicated and indirect, but that is the general theme, whereas white leftists will generally convince themselves that they're doing what is universally good, what's good for humanity, or what's good according to some sort of universalist creed, often preached by sort of left-wing Christian preachers and so on. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. I think the Jews are motivated by what it's going to do for the Jews, because that's what they talk about. And whites will tell themselves that they're doing it because it's universal. But I think in a lot of cases, it's selfishness and it's virtue signaling. And I think what Ed Dutton refers to is he calls them spiteful mutants. And because we don't have the pressures of Darwinian selection on us anymore, so many more of us, about 90% of us are now alive who would have died in early childhood, because we have these mutant genes, and now we grow up to adulthood, and the mutant genes of the body means that we also have mutant brains, and we come out with maladaptive ideas that are harmful to the group. And a large portion of the people that are involved in the left side of politics have faces which betray the fact that they have these mutant genes. They have asymmetrical faces. That's just one side of it. But I think that's sort of paraphrasing Ed Dutton's explanation for why these things happen is because we have so many people out there that aren't the best genetically, so they come out with these maladaptive ideas. When you're pointing out the different strategies there, I think Black's strategy is just to have as many of them as possible. You know, they're like 10, 12 in a family, they will massively reproduce, and that is their strategy. Whereas if you look at Jews, they're a tiny minority to have reached the influence that they have. It's quite incredible when you think about it, because they are a microscopic minority, and yet the numbers of them that are involved in influential things such as intellectual movements or politics, particularly in the media, it's 50 to 100 times their percentage of the population. They've managed to get that far from just being a tiny group without having the power of the numbers, say. Whereas Blacks have just got masses and masses of numbers of them, and they reproduce very, very quickly, particularly over the last century. They've exponentially increased the population of Africa, and we'll probably end up seeing the same thing here. So each group has a different strategy of advancing its own interests. And E. Michael Jones' explanation for it would be that because the Jews rejected Jesus Christ was the Logos incarnate, and the Logos is the order of the universe, so that's why they are against order. Because when they rejected Christ, they rejected the order of the universe, and that's the way they've been ever since. That's his religious explanation for it, which, as we pointed out before, all the evidence that Kevin McDonald comes up with for his evolutionary explanation for it is the same evidence that E. Michael Jones comes up with for his religious explanation of it. So I think there's truth in... There's truth in both of them. Well, the first quote that I've got here is to do with the Bolsheviks. And again, this is Kevin McDonald. He says, there is good evidence that both in the Tsarist period and in the post-revolutionary period, Jewish Bolsheviks perceived their activities as entirely congruent with Jewish interests. The revolution ended the officially anti-Semitic Tsarist government, and although popular anti-Semitism continued in the post-revolutionary period, the government officially outlawed anti-Semitism. Jews were highly overrepresented in positions of economic and political power, as well as cultural influence, at least into the 1940s. It was also a government that aggressively attempted to destroy all vestiges of Christianity as a socially unifying force within the Soviet Union, while at the same time it established a secular Jewish subculture so that Judaism would not lose its group continuity or its unifying mechanisms, such as the Yiddish language. So you've got two things here, really. The government outlawed anti-Semitism, and they did that with some savage penalties. It was a capital offence to be found guilty of anti-Semitism. And at the same time, they were removing the churches, turning the churches into secular places, museums, and I think there's one place in Lithuania where they changed it into an astronomy thing so you could look at the stars, but at the same time encouraging the building of synagogues. So the breaking down of this traditional grouping for the non-Jews, which was as Christians in churches, breaking that down, but while at the same time allowing a secular Jewish subculture. So they weren't just having their synagogues, but they had this new secular culture where they retained their Jewish ethnicity but weren't quite so religious. And they also had state sponsorship of the Yiddish language, and they got funding to do things in Yiddish, whereas the Christians had all their funding removed and the churches were broken down. So all of these things are positive things for the Jews, although they're negative things for whites, particularly the white Russians. So you can see there that's one reason why they joined up with this. And I don't think the Tsarist government was that anti-Semitic, to be honest. He had done lots of things for the Jews, but they not enough for them, apparently. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson's gone into a lot of detail on the previous Tsarist government. And also there was American influence on this as well, on this Bolshevik revolution. And Americans were funding it. American bankers, well, Jewish American bankers were funding it. It was a worldwide effort, really, for this Bolshevik revolution, because you had you had Jews coming over from Canada to Germany to Russia and bringing money with them from America in order to lead the revolution in Russia. And once they had overturned the Tsar and they had taken power, then it was their chance to bring in all these ideas they had of overturning the existing order and introducing a new one, a new utopian order of the Jewish mind, basically their idea of how order should be. And we can see how that ended up. Have you got any comments on the Jews and the Bolsheviks, Horace?
Many, yeah. I realized as well, you mentioned Karl Marx himself earlier. I actually think Karl Marx is sort of, you also mentioned the Jewish revolutionary spirit by E. Michael Jones. I mean, who better embodies that than Karl Marx himself? I was going to say he's the epitome of that, but arguably you could say the Bolsheviks epitomize that, because Karl Marx, although he's a revolutionary, I made a video a couple of months ago with two friends of mine who I'm also going to be doing another recording with soon. And it's called Karl Marx the Nationalist, which is a bit of a sort of cheeky title. It's not supposed to be entirely serious. But apparently Karl Marx founded the first International Working Men's Association in, I think, the 1840s, as a way, my friend argues, this is one perspective, I'd like to hear counter arguments, but as a way of actually stopping international capital or the state acting for capital from importing foreign labor forces into Britain and other developed countries, to stop capital using them as basically scab labor to drive down the existing workers' wages, and which gives a different, if that's true, if that's the best way to interpret Marx, it's very, very interesting, because it makes one wonder, when did Marxists become anti-nationalist in the way that they are now? I mean, there's hardly a Marxist alive now who would take the position that Marx took at the time in the 40s and 50s, 1840s and 50s. Marx himself is actually, I think, worthy of further study. But the Marxists who formed the Mensheviks and Bolsheviks, were overwhelmingly Jewish and were, I mean, Lenin took the position during the First World War that the key thing for leftist revolutionaries like him to do was to oppose their own government. He thought that the Tsarist regime was especially malignant. Now, I would agree to some extent in that I think the Tsarist regime had a large degree of culpability in causing the war, but that's not what Lenin meant. I think Lenin, the sort of Jew was coming out in Lenin when he said that. And Lenin was only one quarter Jewish, so it is debatable how much that matters. But then there are Jews who've only got, there are people with only sort of 1/8 or 1/16 Jewish ancestry who really do cleave to it. So that's sort of, I don't know, that's a question for further inspection at some other time. But obviously of the first central committee of the Bolshevik Party, of the Bolshevik government, I think a huge proportion, maybe a quarter or a third, were Jews against sort of, I don't know, 1% of the population, something like that. And of the, I think the original, I can't remember what's the supreme body that had only seven people in. I think three or four of those were of Jewish or part Jewish ancestry. I got the numbers wrong there. I think it was slightly bigger, maybe nine people, but something like four of the, I mean, there was Zinoviev, Trotsky, Kamenev were full Jews, and then Lenin was partly Jewish. Others had Jewish wives as well. That's never counted. Gentiles with Jewish wives who can be very influential on them and can, sort of amend and affect their views of what's right and wrong in relation to ethnicity. The behaviour of a lot of the Jews in the Cheka, which later became the OGPU and then the KGB later on, certainly in the original Red Terror in the first few years of the Bolshevik regime, is just frequently described as, not just ruthless, but cruel and vengeful. And that seems to have been ethnically motivated. The hatred and also, like I'm talking about at the time, but also the castigation that's continued since of the Tsar's regime does seem to be largely based on this perception, I think it's probably mostly false, but this perception that it was an anti-Semitic regime. As far as I can tell, especially from the writings of Andrew Joyce. And I did a conversation with Andrew Joyce recently on my BitChute channel, if people want to see, it's the second or third last video, about the Russian pogroms narrative, especially the Kishinev pogrom of 1903, and then there was another in 1905. Whether they should be called pogroms at all is highly doubtful. But that narrative was spread around the world that you know, Jews were being slaughtered for being Jews. That was that, you know, it was just a regime that hated Jews for no particular reason. As, you know, this virus of anti-Semitism idea, the virus struck there at that time for some reason. And people weren't wearing masks, obviously, and and hadn't been vaccinated. And yeah, so the narrative was there, whether or not it was true. And I think, you know, a lot of activists, especially on the left, especially Jewish activists, are prepared to act on a narrative regardless of the truth, just because it's useful. There was also, I mean, the involvement of Jacob Schiff and other Jewish financiers in supporting Japan in their war against Russia in 1904, 1905. I think those things are all related, you know, the perception of the Tsarist regime as anti-Semitic. But yeah, certainly when, as we can see, you know, as soon as the Bolsheviks took over, it was a regime that, yeah, overtly and cruelly persecuted Christians and appears not to have done the same to Jews, and obviously gave Jews immense opportunities that they never had before. And obviously a lot of the Jews that got into high positions, you know, had this vengeful or just cruel attitude towards, you know, what they saw or what they'd told themselves were their oppressors. I really think that narrative was false. And then I think with Stalin, obviously over the 20s, he defeated the triumvirate of Trotsky, Zinoviev and Kamenev, who were all Jewish. And Stalin, you know, people make some case that Stalin was anti-Semitic, but this is really, really complicated. I think that's largely wrong, but there's a few things you can adduce towards that. But by the time of the Second World War, Jews were immensely important again, or, you know, resurgently important in the Soviet Union. And there's a book by Benjamin Ginsberg, a very pro-Jewish book, but it's very frank and honest, called How the Jews Defeated Hitler. And that lays out that basically it's hard to see how the Soviet Union would have succeeded were it not for, you know, in its war against Germany, how it would have succeeded and how it would have carried out the war in the way that it did without Jews in high positions. And I'll hand it back in a second, but just to mention a couple of things in the war. Most of the leading propagandists in the Soviet Union were Jewish, certainly including Vasily Grossman, who was a writer and journalist, and the infamous Ilya Ehrenberg, who made up the soap claim, the turning Jews into soap claim in the concentration camps. Those are just the two most famous. There were loads of others. The political commissariat was led by a Jew called Lev Mekhlis, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. But anyway, sorry, Sven, I'll hand it back to you.
Well, it's one of their many talents, isn't it, is within the media. So you would expect them to get involved in propaganda. And, you know, we see them doing this in Hollywood and with television. So they're well placed to be involved in that with the Bolsheviks and in the Bolshevik Revolution. But one thing that Kevin MacDonald talks about is the fact that they try to cover it up today by saying that these Jews weren't religious Jews. They gave up their religion to join communism, Bolshevism, which was universalism and against all nationalisms. Well, they may have given up the religious side of it, but they still identified as Jews. As we see, they were still speaking in Yiddish. They had all these secular things, but they were Jewish secular things where everybody spoke Yiddish, and that's what was funded. And they retained their loyalties to other Jews, particularly with Israel. Once Israel really started taking off and the Soviet Union was against Israel, then there was a bit of a split, and there were Jews wanting to leave Russia to go to Israel. And a lot of people will think, well, the Soviets must have supported the Zionists because they're both Jews, but it didn't originally start out like that. They were against Zionism because Zionism was nationalism, which caused confusion in these Jews, because they're claiming to be secular and they don't have these loyalties anymore, and yet they're feeling these loyalties for the Israeli Jews. So you know, this idea that once they give up religion that they cease to be Jews, that doesn't really cut it. You know, they continue.
Yeah, it's I mean, anyone who treats Jewishness as just a religious thing will just not understand. I mean, it seems to be, you know, you don't have to be religious to be a Jew and to be a very active and effective one. It's definitely not reducible to religion. It seems like you can be a Jew either or both by ethnic solidarity or religion, and I think the ethnic solidarity is the more fundamental to it. Would you agree with that?
Definitely, because they still remain Jews, whether they're atheists or whether they're religious Jews. And we can look and see that the same thing was going on in Poland. This is another quote. While the government campaigned actively against the political and cultural power of the Catholic Church, collective Jewish life flourished in the post-war period. Yiddish and Hebrew language schools and publications were established, as well as a great variety of cultural and social welfare organizations for Jews. A substantial percentage of the Jewish population was employed in Jewish economic cooperatives. So that's in Poland, with the new government that Poland had after the war. A large portion of them were Jews. And when you were pointing out there that a lot of them joined the security services, and this is because they didn't have these loyalties to the rest of the population. And the Soviets didn't want people in the security services that had loyalties to the rest of the population. They wanted a brutal reign of terror. So that's what the Jews were used for, because they had this grudge, and that grudge was encouraged. And a similar thing happened in Poland as well. It was slightly different in America. That started out with Jews that were involved in labor and that were part of the working class, and they joined the Communist Party. And then gradually over the century, they left the working class and became the rich intellectuals by the time we get to the 60s. But in the 50s, 50% of the membership of the Communist Party in the United States was Jewish. And earlier than that, it started out and they were working class Jews. But by the time we get to the 60s and the 70s, and the Jews are in the universities, these communist Jews, they're all from wealthy upper class families. I just found that interesting, the way that just in the life of the Communist Party in America, the Jews managed to work their way up from this working class up to the upper class. But again, what we see happening in Poland there is the same oppression of the Christians and the raising up of the Jews and promoting their welfare organizations. When it says that they had these cultural and social welfare organizations, it means it was the state that was paying for them. It was the state that was encouraging them. It wasn't the Jews that set them up themselves. And the language schools and all the rest of it, and teaching them about their history, that was all paid for by the state while the church was being obliterated. So again, we see the collectivization of the non-Jews is pushed away, and the promotion of the collectivization of Jews is encouraged. And we don't just see that happening in the Soviet Union. I mean, we see that happening now in all countries. Identification of non-Jews together in any groups is forbidden, and it's pathologized. Whereas the collecting together of Jews into groups is encouraged, and they'll promote this breaking down of the group identities right from the very top, right the way through our schools now. People are taught not if they're white, they're taught not to identify with whites. But back then, I guess when we're talking about the time of the Soviet Union, you know, the racial issues that we have now with multiculturalism, they didn't really exist. What you had in Poland, you had Poles and you had Jews. You just had whites and Jews, basically. Whereas now there's even more confusion has been added to the mix by bringing in black Africans and non-white Pakistanis and all these other races that we have amongst us. And again, that's of benefit to Jews because they don't stand out so much, and they prefer to be amongst a multicultural society. But if it's your society that's then become multicultural, it breaks it up, it divides it, and you can't have the unity that's needed to advance your own group's interests. But that wasn't really a large part of the Soviet was racial side of things. They were just against Nazis. Oh, there was also the Jewish Antifa Anti-fascists started out as the Jewish anti-fascists in the Soviet Union as well. So there's always been a Jewish component to that as well. I don't know if there's anything in that that you'd like to pick up on, Horace.
Loads, yeah. I mean, Antifa, that should be understood as an arm of Jewish activism, as far as I'm concerned. I made a video, it's on my BitChute channel, called Death by Community Self-Defense, if people want to watch that, more about that. And yeah, I think I assume what you're referring to there is the Jewish Anti-Fascist Something Committee, which existed during the Second World War. That was actually a Jewish named Antifa organization that linked up people like Ilya Ehrenberg with writers in Britain and America. That was actually designed to internationalize the sort of, I don't know, yeah, Jewish led response and to recruit Jews to the cause of fighting Nazi Germany, which is funny because I would have thought most of them would have been against it anyway. But that was one part of the sort of Soviet outreach, global outreach. About what you said about the Communist Party in America, just it's very interesting that you said more than half of the membership was Jewish in the 1950s. That's obviously 30 or 40 years after that party had been formed. I believe Kevin McDonald points out that earlier it was even higher. We were talking about 80, 90%. So getting to, you know, just but still a majority by the 1950s, that will be after, I imagine, a conscious effort to bring in as many Gentiles as possible so that it wouldn't look like an overtly Jewish organization, but it still should largely be understood as one. And what you said about Poland, yeah, that's one example of several of basically at the end of the Second World War, the Soviets obviously occupied all of Eastern and much of Central Europe. And they imposed governments completely in flagrant violation of what had been agreed. Well, actually, maybe not in violation, but by using different interpretations of words like democracy. Obviously, democracy means something different in the communist lexicon. It basically means communist control. But the Soviets obviously occupied all that at the end of war, and they imposed governments that they had trained in Moscow under the Comintern, Communist International. And that organization was obviously, that existed to spread communism around the world. And yeah, during the war, you know, governments were prepared because the Soviets knew from probably 1942 by Stalingrad at the latest, by the victory at Stalingrad at the latest. But I think from the way Stalin talked, actually quite a bit earlier. So they knew for several years before they took over Eastern Europe that they were going to control these areas. They trained up governments, new governments in advance. And one thing about the Soviet regime is that almost the entire diplomatic corps was populated by Jews. I mean, if you look at the ambassador to France, to Britain, to Germany, at any time, almost all of them are Jewish throughout at least the first few decades. Ivan Maisky was the one in Britain, one of the more famous ones, but yeah, loads of others as well. That's because many, many Jews spoke many languages, because Jews are just generally more international than other people. We're trained in languages, we're good at learning new languages if they needed to. So that would have been a factor in the running of the Comintern and the new governments that occupied all of Eastern Europe would have been trained, you know, by people like that. Not only Poland, but Romania, Hungary, also elements of the Czech regime, they were all heavily Jewish, all the like key posts, especially, I think in all of them, the, you know, head of security, head of internal security, the equivalent of the KGB or the Gestapo would have been led by a Jew. So in Romania, like the leading positions were all Jewish, in Poland, Hungary. The Soviets were well aware of what they were doing. They were using essentially one ethnicity to repress another. The Soviets, I think, just found that the most effective way of crushing the people, or thought that it would be. But it actually triggered off several rebellions. There was a national rebellion across East Germany. I don't think the East German regime was very Jewish, but there was a rebellion there and several came within a few years of each other. There was a rebellion in Poland that was crushed by violence. There's hardly any footage of it because the press was kept out so effectively. But that led to somewhat of a change of government. I mean, it still had to be hardline communist, obviously. But a lot of the Jews were removed. I think that was in about 1953. The East German rebellion was in 53 as well. And then there was a major rebellion in Hungary. Obviously, this was world news. And David Irving's book on that, I think it's called Uprising, is very, very interesting. He addresses the ethnic angle throughout, and he just says, yeah, I mean, this was the overthrowing of an overtly Jewish regime, a regime that thought of itself as Jewish. Matthias Rákosi was the leader, and he said, like, we this is too obviously Jewish what we're doing, but he didn't change it in time. That regime also used gypsies to evict native Hungarians from their homes and stuff as well. So again, clear awareness of their own ethnic, their own ethnicity and how it affected things and how they saw the people under them. Romania as well, I'm a bit less clear about. But a lot of this is laid out in Anne Applebaum's book. I mean, she's obviously, she's a Jew herself. She's very pro-Jewish and neocon. Her book, I can't remember what it's called. Iron Curtain. It's called Iron Curtain. She lays out quite a lot of detail in this. She's not a great writer, but she lays out plenty of relevant information for people who want to know more about that. And then, yeah, I mean, this was happening at the same time that Israel was becoming more and more important as well. I believe the Soviets supported, and the Soviet satellite regimes, I think especially Czechoslovakia with its arms manufacturing capabilities, supported Israel in its first year or two, maybe a bit longer. But that relationship went cold quite quickly, and that, you know, like Zionism is an angle on all of this, but that would sort of get us onto a different topic. So I'll hand it back.
Yeah, I was just going to point out where you were saying there that they become aware of the fact that there is this ethnic component and that people might spot that. They certainly realised that in America, and there was a big drive to get more American non-Jews to join the Communist Party, but also in Poland. And they, in actual fact, in Poland, they were trying to get Jews that didn't quite look so Jewish and getting them to dress as if they weren't Jewish, to pretend that they were Polish. So they certainly knew that there was this ethnic component, even though they were secular, even if they were atheists, they still knew that they were Jews, and they were still self-aware that it was starting to look a little bit too Jewish. And I think what we can see there is at this time, it was definitely Jews on the left and non-Jews on the right. But then after the war, they've ended up somehow being able to have a large influence on the right as well. Whereas before the war, I don't think they can have been that influential on the right. Can you think of any Jews that were prominent in speaking up against communism? Because, I mean, there may have been some. I mean, we had Disraeli, the Prime Minister, before we actually had communism, and people always thought of Disraeli as a you know, a very good sort of right-wing Prime Minister. But I'm just wondering whether there were any that actually spoke out against communism during the time. Can you think of any?
In Britain?
Well, anywhere.
In America, you did have some, like the Austrian school and the Chicago school, I think would have both been explicitly anti-communist, yeah. And they were mostly Jewish. I mean, Murray Rothbard I really admire Murray Rothbard. He is sort of my favourite Jew in history. But he wrote, yeah, very extensively against all sorts of left-wing beliefs and, you know, authentically. And he seems to be one Jew who I think, you know, was aware of, you know, knew his own ancestry, but he thought that shouldn't be the determinant of how you act. And I think he's been referred to by some as Aristotelian kind of thinker. Like, he embraced this sort of Athenian spirit intellectually. So yeah, he was very much a critic of communism. And there were some others, but in Britain, I struggle. There must have been some. I think Alfred Sherman was one. He was a communist himself when he was young, turned very strongly against it. And he was an advisor to Thatcher, who, once she got in government, I think he got sidelined. Keith Joseph would have been another. He was sort of just went along with the Keynesian consensus until he realised that it was full of problems, and he became strongly anti-socialist and anti-communist as well. They were both sort of, you know, I'm talking 70s, 80s. Before that, I'm struggling to think of one. Can you think of any?
No, I can't. I was just thinking, so it was mainly the Jews were in the majority. They were in supportive of this left-wing cause and supportive of Bolshevism, but there were still a few that would speak up against it, but I guess maybe 90% of them were supportive of these left-wing ideas.
There would have been a lot of Jewish businessmen with a lot to lose from communism. I assume they could be counted as not being in favour of it. But yeah, I mean, in terms of Jewish political activists and media activists and so on, and academics, I'm sure it was many and growing until a certain point. And you also had Marxist Jews who were allowed to move into Britain and settle and get academic positions. I'm thinking immediately of Isaac Deutscher, who was a big admirer of Trotsky. And yeah, I mean, a Marxist Jew who moved into Britain, I think during, I'm not sure if it was before the war or during the Cold War, I'm not sure, but that's one example of Britain's, I would say, absurd and self-destructive openness to foreign subversives, which I'm hoping to make a video about myself in the coming weeks.
I'm just recalling there, I'm sure there was something I read around about the 1900s, there were Jews coming over from Eastern Europe. And the Jews that were actually in Britain already were worried about them. And these were anarchist-type Jews that were involved in terrorism and setting bombs off and things. And they were quite concerned. But apparently they were just immigrating to Britain. I guess trading on the good reputation of the Jews that were already here. Maybe the ones that were already here were Sephardic and the ones that were coming over were Ashkenazi or something.
I do believe there's a difference between the two. I mean, there will be some subversive Sephardis, obviously, but I think Sephardis were far more assimilated and somewhat less revolutionary and sort of less hostile to the host society. I mean, the Sephardis would still include the Rothschilds, who obviously had no compunctions about using, British power for Jewish ends, I would say, and Zionist ends later on in the 20th century. But I mean, there's no clear-cut sort of cleavage between the two, but I think the Ashkenazi immigration, as I understand it, that sort of stretches over from sort of mid-19th century into sort of mid-20th century, with most of it happening late 19th, early 20th, and especially triggered off by these so-called pogroms, which appear to be mostly massively exaggerated. That was another part of the discussion I had with Andrew Joyce, if anyone wants to watch that. But yeah, I mean, that, like, a lot of people speak of mass immigration into Britain as having started in, with the Windrush in 1948. I think that's kind of a mistake. There was a long, slow, but large wave of Jewish immigration into Britain, which I think numbered about 300,000 people. Still, I think, less than 1% of the British population, depending on when you count. But as we see, small numbers of Jews can have an immense impact, and those guys did. That is going to be the subject of my next video. So,
I think I had a listen to the podcast that you did with Andrew Joyce, and I think you were saying that wasn't it British investigators that went over and discovered that these stories had been exaggerated and that they couldn't find the evidence for them for the pogroms? Is that right? Was it British Secret Service or British journalists?
Some from the maybe from the British Foreign Office, I think. Yeah,
British
yeah.
Foreign
and
Office.
Just a rational assessment finds that there's just no evidence of a mass killing.
So it was official people that didn't have an axe to grind against the Jews that actually went over there and discovered this, and that there were other reports of the intelligence services going over to Russia and reporting on the Jewish component to the Bolshevik Revolution, and I think that gave rise to Winston Churchill's condemnation of it, and he condemned this Jewish component, which is very surprising, because Winston Churchill was, essentially was brought up by Jews, and he thought very highly of them. We've gone into that in a series before. And when you brought up Rothschild there, I mean, he's a very good example of someone with loyalty to his people. I mean, they've made masses of money, but a lot of it's been invested into Israel setting up a homeland for his extended kinship group. So imagine we can criticize the Rothschilds for some of the effects that they have had on our people. As far as actually looking after his own people is concerned, then you can't actually fault that. And that's the way that we have to look at these things. The Jews are looking out for their own people, which is a good thing. Our problem is that we have stopped looking out for our own people, and that's what we need to be working on.
I think we would do well by emulating the best aspects of what they do, but while still being ourselves, still retaining the best aspects of our ways as well. But we could certainly learn a lot, and just trying to condemn them for what they do really gets us nowhere. It's a case of be realistic, but try and learn from them as well, and
adapt. Learn from it and adapt. That's the way to think about it. Adapt. We need to work out our counter strategies. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Horace. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.